Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Dr. Chanapatna Prakash. He's a professor of plant molecular genetics at Tuskegee University in Alabama. He's also the director of Ag BioWorld, which is a group seeking to educate the public and be an information resource on agricultural biotechnology. Welcome, Dr. Prakash.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
As I've said, I'm a huge fan of the work that you do. And so explain, how old is Ag BioWorld and what exactly is the purview of the work that you're doing?
Okay, Ag BioWorld is about 4 years old. We started this primarily to help provide a balance and scientific information on some of the emerging issues related to agricultural biotechnology. And our primary focus is on genetically modified crops. You know, these crops were introduced about 8-9 years ago and have met with certain apprehension and skepticism. Especially overseas, and we recognize that a lot of us scientists who are working in biotechnology that that use of this technology would, in a responsible manner, would bring considerable benefit to the mankind. But at the same time, this technology is not going to be easily accepted because this is a new technology that can bring certain level of apprehension, and it is also met with a lot of myths and misinformation. So Ag BioWorld was started primarily to bring together the scientific community to help explain to the public and other stakeholders what this technology is about, what are the benefits of this technology, and how are we ensuring that these genetically modified crops are safe.
Now, one of the first things that you did was you organized a declaration in support of agricultural biotechnology, and that's now been signed by hundreds of scientists and 25 mm-hmm. Nobel laureates, as I
that's
understand.
That's correct. Yeah, I think it brought a certain level of newsworthiness to the whole issue when we had all these very well-known scientists signing on to the declaration. The declaration simply says that this is a technology that has substantial potential to help contribute to the humanity by increasing food production, by cutting down on the use of chemicals on the farm, and by making food more nutritious. And we have a regulatory system in this country that ensures those products released from this technology are safe. And so if you agree with it, could you just sign on to that? And any scientist could do that at my website, agbioworld.org. And so I just said, you know, by word of mouth, literally thousands of scientists signed on to it. And also I personally went after some high-profile scientists like the Nobel laureates, and I was able to convince about 25 of them to sign on to this.
Let's define our terms a little bit, because I'm not sure that everyone, and I don't exactly know what we mean by agricultural biotechnology.
Sure. Well, agricultural biotechnology is a very broad term that includes a whole range of techniques used to improve agricultural productivity. Biotechnology, in a very broad way, is the use of any living organism to help the humankind. But then that includes, all kinds of, like, farming, and some of the very historical application of biotechnology includes making wine, beer, yogurt, and cheese. But in the modern sense, the biotechnology means the use of recombinant DNA technology, primarily transferring genes from one organism to another organism. But agriculture biotechnology includes some of these techniques of gene transfer, but also other techniques such as DNA fingerprinting that many of your listeners are familiar with, that are used in forensics. But we also use that in agriculture, in trying to identify different varieties of crop plants and livestock. And we also use those such similar DNA markers to guide us in breeding and in selecting superior types of crop plants. And those are not controversial. The controversial aspect of agriculture biotechnology is the so-called GM crops. The GM crops stand for genetically modified crops. And these crops have been developed by where scientists have introduced one or two genes from outside the crop species into this crop to make it say, more resistant to an insect or an herbicide, or to make it more nutritious. To give you an example, practically all the cotton that we grow in this country today, about 80% of them, has carries a gene that we have introduced from a bacteria, a soil bacterium, that is a natural pest of this. This is a natural pathogen of a cotton pest called cotton bollworm. And so this genetically engineered cotton carries this gene. We don't have to spray against cotton bollworm. And this has been a huge success amongst all the cotton-growing states in this country, so much so that there is a huge reduction in the pesticide use on cotton. We are nearly saving about 20 million kilograms of pesticide every year.
There was a recent study from China where they looked at the farmers who were using genetically modified crops over there, and they found that the farmers were healthier, too, because they weren't being exposed to these pesticides and fertilizers.
Oh, exactly. This study just came out in China, just talked about rice, but this has been very clearly documented in cotton in China, and I have also personally seen that happen in India, my own native country. You see, because the modern agriculture entails use of many of these chemicals, especially pesticides, and that is one of the very negative consequences of this industrial agriculture. And hopefully biotechnology will help reduce the use of both pesticides and also fertilizers on the farm, so that not only we have a healthier environment, but we would also reduce the damage of these chemicals on the farm workers. You know, I have seen 12, 13-year-old boys being employed to spray these pesticides in the countryside on the farms in India and many other third world countries. And this is really horrible, because most of these young children who are being employed for spraying pesticides, they would not be wearing gloves, they would not have any protective gear, and a lot of times wrong concentrations or very high concentration of pesticides are being used. And so there is a tremendous health consequence of the use of these pesticides. So any technology that helps us to reduce the amount of these chemicals that we use on our farms, it's clearly going to help both farmers and also consumers.
Well, this is very interesting, because one of the conspiracy theories that I frequently hear about genetically modified crops is that it's a way for these companies to engineer crops which will have a higher tolerance to pesticides, so that they can sell more pesticides, so that they can have, you know, so that you could lay down the pesticide to kill all the weeds and not kill the crop itself. So there are two possible directions that this kind of genetic modification could go, one which would not reduce our reliance on these chemicals, and one which would, right?
Well, you know, here you got to differentiate between pesticides and herbicides. What you're talking about is increasing the chemical usage is the herbicide. And again, there are a lot of companies that are developing herbicide-tolerant crops, and they're very popular amongst farmers. What it does is that, like soybean and corn, have been engineered with the herbicide tolerance gene, so that farmers, when they spray Roundup herbicide that kills practically all the crops and also the weeds, would now only kill the weeds and not the crops, so that they would have a higher productivity. You know, they don't have any losses. And this has led to the conspiracy theories that you're mentioning. But what is happening here, you must understand here, that we have a farmers, when they use herbicide-tolerant crops, are using more safer herbicides now. Herbicides like Roundup are much safer than some of the other herbicides like 2,4-D. And what we are seeing is not necessarily an increase in the consumption of herbicides, but a switch from one type of herbicide to another type. And even if there's an increase in the use of herbicide, the environmental consequence of that is not going to be as bad as an increase in pesticides, because pesticides are very, very toxic. You know, not all two chemicals are the same. You see, you can talk about H2O, you can talk about H2O2. One is water and another is hydrogen peroxide that's used in Clorox too. So there are various levels of toxicity that we are talking about. And some of them, like Roundup, is an herbicide that's fairly benign, and it's the toxicity level is almost as much as common salt.
I'm talking with Dr. Chanapatna Prakash. He's a professor of plant molecular genetics at Tuskegee University and the director of Ag BioWorld, which you can find at agbioworld.org. Another one of the concerns that the critics often express is a concern about genetic pollution and the notion that these genes could spread from the engineered crops into the wild and have some kind of unpredictable environmental consequences. Do you think that we have adequate protections in the application and the use of these technologies so that, we will control this risk of genetic pollution? Is it a real risk?
Well, yeah. To answer your question, first of all, yes, we have adequate controls here. We have a regulatory system that asks all the possible questions and the likely scenarios of what can go wrong. And when you look at the history of, we've been growing these crops for the past 10 years now, and we have planted almost, this year we're going to be planting, sometime this weekend actually, 1 billion acre of this genetically modified crop over the past 10 years in a cumulative manner. And if something could have gone wrong, it would have gone wrong by now. And the fact that nothing has gone wrong assures us that these crops are in no way different from traditionally bred crops. And so what we call as genetic pollution is just a play on the emotional part of the people who are not well informed about this and just creates a scare. We must understand that intermingling of genes is very common amongst all crop plants. And as plant breeders, we have always tried to keep our seeds pure, and there are ways of keeping a particular variety pure by whatever the different means of that. But if your introduced gene does not have any, the likelihood of your introduced genes escaping is the same as any other genes that are there in the plant. And the point is, such genes do get out all the time, like for instance from a crop plant into a wheat species or into other varieties. The question then we must ask is, so what? Is that going to be of any consequence from an environmental or health point of view? In most cases, the answer is no.
Well, one of the things that always puzzled me about that part of the debate, the genetic pollution debate, was that the best way, it seems, to make sure that you didn't have that problem would be to introduce sterility into GM crops so that if the crop did, in fact, escape the bounds of the field, it wouldn't reproduce elsewhere. But, of course, when Monsanto was doing research on making a sterile line of crops, the GM opponents freaked out about that, too, because they didn't want farmers to have to buy the crop every time. So do you have an opinion about what was called then the Terminator gene research and whether Monsanto should have pursued that? Is the Terminator gene the solution to this potential risk of genetic pollution?
Yes, I definitely think that it can be one of the solutions, the so-called Terminator genes, where the second generation of seeds from these crops would not germinate, and they could conceivably be used in some really high-risk situations, like, when we are putting certain genes for producing some very high-value pharmaceutical compounds in crop plants, or biodegradable plastics, some industrial compounds that are genetically engineered into crop. These are niche crops, and you don't want these crops to get out and get into your food supply. You don't want to be eating a corn in your, in cornflakes that has a gene engineered for producing some specialty chemical. And in those instances, yes, you are very much right. We could introduce a sterile type of situation where these plants do not germinate. And that's one. And we could also put these genes in so-called chloroplasts or plastids, which are maternally inherited, so they don't get out into the pollen. And so there is very less risk of this contaminating other varieties or those seeds that are used for food. One of the things that people are doing also is like growing corn in Arizona, where traditionally food-type corn is not grown. So they're using these specialty chemicals. There's a company that are growing some crops like these in caves in Missouri, in underground caves, so that they are kept in a fairly quarantined manner. So there are several ways of doing it, and we have always grown crops for, like in rapeseed, there's a type of canola or rapeseed that's grown where industrial types grown along with the regular food types. And we could, by certain measures, we can keep that they do not commingle.
Another one of the issues that's come out recently is this, is it Monsanto that developed the golden rice, the rice?
No.
Who did that?
Well, it was developed actually by a university scientist in Switzerland called Ingo Patrikas, and he collaborated with another scientist called Bayer in Germany, and they together developed this golden rice. And Syngenta, a chemical company in Switzerland, later helped pay for some of the tests that need to be done for this rice and also acquired certain rights to use this rice commercially. What this golden rice does is, it, for the first time, it provides vitamin A precursor, beta-carotene, in rice. And this is very important because, you know, about 3 to 4 billion people eat rice every day. And some of the very poor countries in Asia, like Burma and even parts of India, Cambodia, there is a very severe vitamin A deficiency because rice does not have any vitamin A. And as a consequence of that, about 500,000 children go blind every year. And about 2 million children die because of lack of vitamin A in the diet. It impairs your immune function and predisposes these children to diseases such as measles. So this rice has been engineered so that it has been genetically fortified to produce the vitamin A precursor, the beta-carotene. And I think this is a marvelous example of a humanitarian application of genetic engineering.
Except that the critics say that it wouldn't actually provide enough vitamin A and that it's just being used as a propaganda ploy to get people to support GM.
Right. I'm aware of that criticism, which was they were wrong. And even otherwise, there's a second generation, second version of this rice that has come up, which has 20-fold more beta-carotene than the first generation. And so, you know, that shows that those critics are simply trying to find fault and not being very reasonable. Look, this golden rice or any one single initiative would not be able to solve a humongous problem such as the micronutrient deficiency that I talked about. But it can be an effective tool because it is not going to cost anything more to grow a different type of rice. It's not going to change the food habits and the food distribution system in any manner. But at the same time, just like we put iodine into our salt or vitamin B12, niacin into the wheat flour, if our vitamin A and also iron can be delivered through rice, through biotechnology, with hardly any additional cost, I think this is one just needs to have an open mind and see how it goes.
Well, let's talk about the distribution for a second, since you mentioned it. Back in the day when I was flirting with vegetarianism, I read Frances Moore LePay's work, and she and many other people argue that the real problem with hunger in the world is with distribution and equity and land ownership and whatnot, and not with technology, that we have enough food to feed everyone. Now, the population of the planet may double in the next 50, 60 years, so you know, obviously that may change, that situation may change. Do you agree that equity is at least as important as the technology end of feeding the world?
Well, yes, in many, yes, it is, because the poverty, hunger, and starvation are due to a variety of reasons. But the question we must be asking is, then what can we do to address this? What is the most effective tool that we have in our hand today to bring a reduction in the starvation and hunger? And if you're talking about equity, yes, the world is unfair. You know, not everyone has the same amount of money, not everyone has the same amount of land or the size of the house or whatever. And in our lifetime or in about 100 or 200 years, that is not going to be solved. So the point is, in the absence, and what can we do to practically bring an equity in the access of food? And the best way to do that is to look at what science and technology can offer to help bring about inequities in food production. And that will help in food distribution eventually. You see, the point is, what I'm trying to say is, if there is a lack of food production, say, in northern Kenya, there is, it does not help the Kenyans or the Somalis or Ethiopians today who are facing drought, that there's excess food production in Iowa. Yes, there's a problem of equity, there's a problem of distribution, but how are you going to help it? If you take the grain that is produced in Iowa and dump it in Ethiopia, you're going to kill the main source of livelihood in that part of the world that is farming. So I think the point here is people in Iowa and Illinois have learned, have managed to harness the power of science and technology in such a fantastic manner to improve the productivity of their land and so also improve the quality of their life and their community. So can the Ethiopians and the Somalis and Afghanis or whatever in the third world who can benefit from this technology in developing crop plants that are more tolerant to drought, that are more tolerant to diseases and pests, that have a higher nutrition value, and they are able to produce more, and that way we can bring about those inequities in agriculture production, which has resulted in some of these inequities in food access and resulting hunger problem. There are a lot of other hunger problems, such as what you see in North Korea, for instance, which is purely political, and there is nothing much any technology can do about it. And so brushing aside the importance of technology in saying that we have plenty of food in the world is a very disingenuous argument, primarily because you must understand that 90% of the corn and soybean that we produce in this country is fed to livestock to produce meat. And we can't just say, okay, now we're going to ask all industrialized countries to be vegetarians and we're going to take all these grains and send it to all those starving countries. That's not going to happen. And so we need to be practical about it and not just have very romantic notions like Francis Lappe and others that you mentioned, because they don't offer any solutions. They just talk about some of this in a very poetic manner.
What about intellectual property restrictions and the WTO? I mean, a lot of people are very concerned that with for developing world multinational, transnational companies developing these new strains, that people in the developed world and the people in the developing world will not have adequate access or will be increasingly beholden to these international corporations. Is there some way that we can have a more open source approach or indigenous ownership of these technologies so that farmers would have more control or the developing world would have more control over these technologies?
Right. I think that's a very important issue that you raise, and I very much agree with you that that it is not going to be in the interests of the developing countries if all of this technology is just concentrated in the hands of a handful of companies located in the West. And so there are two possible solutions that are emerging to address this problem. One is just like we have this, that what you mentioned as the open source, we have a similar system in software, like Linux, for instance. There is a group of scientists led by one Dr. Richard Jefferson, an American scientist working in Australia, who is getting together with a group of scientists and funded by Rockefeller Foundation in developing certain enabling technologies in biotechnology that could be used by anyone freely in the developing countries, like open source software. And that is coming along. And second, even these companies, handful of companies such as Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta, who are spending literally billions of dollars in developing very important innovative tools in agriculture biotechnology, have willingly and voluntarily providing their technologies on a royalty-free basis for use by scientists in developing countries for food crops in a way that it is the technology is given free of cost. And that is also a fairly good parallel model. But at this moment, the developing countries, the problem is not the big companies providing their technology, but the problem is the big companies are not investing much in the development of appropriate technologies for the third world, simply because this technology has been mired in a public relations problem. It has not been accepted very well, and many countries many companies do not see much value in spending a great deal of money when there is so much uncertainty about the future of this technology, especially in the West, in Europe, for instance.
That's very much parallel to the medical biotech problem, which is that the top 10 killers around the world are things like cholera.
Mm-hmm. Malaria.
And malaria, but very little of the medical biotech is going into those technologies because there's no one to buy them. There's no money to buy them in the developing world.
Exactly. Very much so. Very much so.
So you would recommend that the developed world, the companies and countries in the developed world, put more money into research into these kinds of solutions.
Oh, certainly. And also, the public sector in the developing countries and the international agriculture research centers that help bring green revolution into many of our countries are joining hands with the local national agriculture research centers in many countries and even with the private sector in collectively developing this technology. But the problem is the investment levels of what you see in public sector is very small compared to the private sector. In the heydays in the late 90s, Monsanto company had a R&D budget of about $1 billion a year. And going on biotechnology of a handful of crops that could be primarily grown in the United States. And you compare it to the research budget of the whole science budget of, a country like Egypt or Argentina, is going to be just a few, tens of millions of dollars for hundreds of subjects. So the point is there is very little research money has been going into biotechnology in developing countries in the public sector. And that must increase because we still have a situation out of 6 billion people in this world, about a billion still go to bed hungry every day, starving. And we clearly have the means, the wherewithal to bring an end to that and to produce food in places where food cannot be grown very well today, and that technology like biotechnology can clearly help. And I think it would be very irresponsible on the part of policymakers and those responsible that if we ignore this important tool and let continue to slide backwards in our food situation.
This will have to be my last question, but I just wanted to ask whether you thought it was an important turning point when the Catholic Church recently convened an international convocation of scientists to advise them on GM, and they came out very strongly in support of GM as a solution to global hunger. It seemed like that was a very important turning point in the debate.
That's correct. I think, and I was very pleased to be a part of some of those debates at the Vatican myself, and I was very pleased to see that a very conservative, very religious organization like the Catholic Church coming out openly and saying that there is nothing inherently wrong in using the God-given talents to find solutions facing the world. They're also worried about, like you said, about the access to this technology by poor countries, and they're also worried that if a few companies would just dominate this technology in a manner as to deprive the poor people of the value of this technology. And those are some of the real issues. But nevertheless, unlike many of the European countries, the Vatican does not fear the technology itself, and they do see a redeeming value in how it could benefit the humanity.
I want to really thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Dr. Chanapatna Prakash. He's a professor of molecular genetics at Tuskegee University, and he's the director of Ag BioWorld, which can be found at agbioworld.org. Thanks so much for joining us, and keep up the good work, Dr. Prakash.
Thank you very much, sir. I enjoy talking to you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.